Okay. Glow isn't going to be with us today because sadly her father passed away last Sunday, and Bruce was just telling me he went to the funeral this morning and said it was Bruce, you were there. You said it was pretty dreary, wasn't it?
Yes, it was very touching though. His granddaughter spoke, and it was tearful and uplifting at the same time.
Mm-hmm. It was sad. He was about 85 or so.
83, I think.
83. Ended up with double pneumonia.
Yeah.
You know, the flu is going around, but they say that what gets you is the pneumonia after the flu, and it could be rough. We're having that flu epidemic down here. It seems like they always give you the shot, but it's never covering the one that's going to get you. But
we'll send Glow our condolences.
We will.
Yeah, by all means.
Thank you.
We'll do.
Well, it's interesting today, and we've got some people listening who are getting ready to submit their proposals for the first time, and then also some for re-up. So we're going to go through a few things, and before I'm going to do a few announcements in Glow's place, and then we'll talk a little bit about those last minute. We still have a couple of weeks before this is due in terms of the proposals, and we've got some mentors on the line which can provide some helpful hints, and then we'll talk a little bit about retention, placement, and recruitment services. But in terms of the announcements, they're pretty much holding firm. You know, the February 3rd date is going to hold. And as we put in the notes, the way that usually works out is it takes 15 days for the contractors to, one, separate the program into three sections, the program plan. First, they're going to see if everyone qualifies, and who doesn't will be excluded. And then they'll take the ranking criteria, which is the primary part of that, and then they'll take the appendices, and again, 15 pages on each of those. And by the end of February, those not meeting qualifying criteria will be notified. And then, of course, then there's a long wait, and the award announcement in April and May. It takes them a while. First, the contractors get a hold of it, and then they assemble the review panels. And these are people who are primarily very, very acquainted with these programs. And one thing about the regional coordinators who serve on these panels and some of the people from other agencies, they know these programs inside out, and they've been together a long time. So they work pretty well as a group, but they also know pretty well about this subjective or objective attempt to rank these, and they'll of course place the ranking on them, and then they'll have the short list, and that short list will then go into other factors, and it'll be looked at by Maddie, and they'll look at them and look at the distribution, and then you may do some tweaking. They like to have a mix about half. In the past, they've done about half re-ups, people who have performed well and are resubmitting their grants, and then they'll have another half of new grantees, and that may alter depending on the proposals and the number of proposals that are submitted, and then they'll come back and they may readjust that short list, and then of course the funds, which are pretty well set, they'll just dole out all the funds that they've got. And we might have 16 or 17 grant awards. And then, of course, then they'll notify everyone that the award they've been accepted in April or in May. And they've become a lot more efficient at this. It used to take a little bit longer, but they're doing a pretty good job now. Then there's the work plans. And it's not over once they award they tell you you've got your award. Then you've got... They're going to come back and ask for a work plan and the grants forms that have to be filled out, and that'll take in June and July. And then, of course, the email that says that the funds are available will come in August. So the programs can get started in the fall, August, September. The end of the fiscal year for federal government is September So September 31st, the funds have to be all dispersed by that. So that's always been our saving grace. They always have to have these things totally out the door by August 31st. There is also a provision in these grants, the way they're set up, is that you can look back 90 days. So you could spend, once you've been announced that you've gotten the award, you could start spending money up to 90 days before the final award is set. So it allows you to, once it's awarded in June or July, you could spend money in August. And usually, hopefully by that time, you'll have the fund availability, but you could go ahead and start spending it. We're going to have our annual grantee meeting in August. And that's going to be, Bruce, is that going to be the 19th and 20th of August?
Right. Check in on the 18th and should be check out on that Friday.
Okay, so 18th. And then the power days, everyone just gets there on the 18th, and then the 19th and 20th are the power days, and then the 20th, everyone can head on home. So they basically are getting three nights of lodging. They'll have to get there, but after that, we have, is that correct, one meal on your own? One meal provided, and then snacks in the morning?
Right. It's like a continental breakfast in the morning, and there'll be mid-morning and mid-afternoon snacks, and there'll be lunch on the first day.
Right.
So
right.
Two dinners or three if you come in on the 18th, and one lunch or on them.
Okay. Okay. And then, of course, the dinners are on them. So, and it gives them networking time and plenty of snacks. Bruce does a great job on making sure there's lots of snacks during that meeting. So, but that's the grantee meeting is something that you have to budget into your grant proposal. And they were very vague because we hadn't set the time and dates, but you can figure on transportation to Alexandria, Virginia. And then, of course, we'll pay the transportation, we'll pay for the hotels, and then you're going to have to budget in some meals there and incidentals. You may also want to budget in the Brownfields 2015 program. That's going to be, well, our meeting's in August, 19th and 20th. The Brownfields is going to be in September, first part of September. I'll put all these dates in the post-session notes. There is an early bird registration for Brownfields 2015, but that closes on February 1st. So if you're pretty sure you're going to go, you may want to go to the Brownfields 2015 website and put that on there, because if you're going to go, you could get a little discount if you sign up before February 1st. There are some other conferences that we're going to talk about, and you may want to look into those. There's a coming up in March 11th through the 13th, the National Environmental Justice Conference is going to be held in Washington, and I'll put these on the notes, and also a Good Jobs, Green Jobs Conference held in April. So everyone's starting to announce their 2015 conferences and work sessions and registrations. You may want to look at that and see of those if there's any of them that you may want to attend, and whether or not there's early bird registration. You may also want to look into what you have in your state going on with brownfields, because a lot of the states are starting to have their own brownfields conferences. And while they don't spend a lot of time on worker training, it's a good place to make contacts and to meet employers and to see what's going on in the state and actually get into the loop. So you'll want to find out. Oklahoma's got one. Florida's got a really good one. They've expanded into the whole Southeast. Just check your state, and if you're working with the DNR or the Office of Environmental control. You might see if anyone's organizing a national, a statewide brownfields conference. And it's good to go to those. It's also good to go to any of the local economic development meetings that you can go to. Also, there might be some brownfields meetings that you could go to. And, of course, your entree into these meetings is to represent the worker training. And so much of these grants are actually getting out and spending some time with other people in the field. And even though they're not directly involved in worker training, it's very important that that you go there and be a part of it. Did someone just join?
Yes, Lorena with the City of Detroit.
Okay. How are you, Lorena?
I'm good. I apologize for being late.
That's okay. We just got through the initial announcements, and we're going on. But all of those will be in the session notes, so you'll be able to look at those. On the 3rd, anyone who is submitting a grant proposal or re-upping is going to have their proposals in. And you've probably heard this 100 times. You're going to have to submit with grants.gov. And those of you who are not even involved in proposals this year, it's something to start thinking about perhaps for next year or the year after when you decide to re-up. They want everyone to work through grants.gov, and it's not trivial. Once you've done it, it's fairly straightforward. But if you've never done it, it's always, if you could link up with a partner who's going to be a fiscal agent who does it, that's easy. They'll just submit. Often the workforce investment boards have done this before. Universities and colleges have done it before. Independent nonprofits may not have done it so much, and so you either want to link up with someone who's familiar with that or get involved with grants.gov and spend some time on the site, which is also good for finding out what other funding is available and also to get your registration and get that set up. But you're going to want to submit, I would say you would want to submit your proposal certainly by the end of this month, because in case you get rejected or you go through the process and something's wrong, you still have a couple days to recover. So definitely do that. While we're on that subject of proposals and sending in proposals, anyone have any questions or last-minute issues about the proposals? Anyone have any questions that may be in the last segment of this that they're concerned with? Okay. The reason I ask that is, we were talking, Randy and I were talking last week about the attachments, and are you better off putting more in terms of letters in the attachment, letters of support? To the extent you move some of that information into the ranking criteria section, the main section? And really the answers when submitting or resubmitting these proposals, it's very important to look at and keep in mind the overall objective of this program, and it's to place people, to find people who have not have jobs and train them and put them into jobs. So backing off, while that's very simplistic, when you're looking at your proposals, it's real easy to lose sight through the whole writing of the proposal, emphasizing the importance of finding motivated people, training those people, and placing those people. And placement is such an important part of this. And if we look at that as a basic criteria, it's telling you a couple of things. One, very most important, is your relationship to the employers, the people who are going to be hiring these people. Because you could have the greatest recruitment and training, and then you don't have that path into employment. And that will ding you all the time. It's that path into employment. And what's so important is who are going to hire, who is going to hire these people? And of course, certainly you're talking about sources like WIBS who will provide placement services. In fact, we've got MVW WIB. They've got a built-in placement program, so they're working with employers all the time. But the employers, for those who may not connected with the WIBS, and someone just joined?
Yes, Constanza Hazelwood with Northwestern Michigan College.
Okay. Welcome.
Thank you.
We were talking about placing your participants. It's so important both in the letters of support and in your in the main body of the ranking criteria that you talk about this path to employment and how you're going to do it very precisely. And make sure in the ranking criteria that you describe that. Don't assume that they're going to pick up from other parts of the grant or from your appendices or your letters of support that you're automatically they're going to be hiring your people. You really have to demonstrate that. Clearly, the WIBs are such an important part of this, and many of the grantees are WIBs, like MVW WIB, but many are not, and those who are not have to, and so do the WIBs, reach out to the employers directly, and they might be doing that through alumni, using employers as instructors. Last week we talked about the problem of placing people in wastewater jobs. And the problem with wastewater jobs is they're municipal jobs, and often it's the people getting the jobs, I don't want to say patronage so much, but they come in not necessarily knowing anything, and they're trained on the jobs, and then some of the best ones are sent up for certification, and they kind of move them up the ladder. And the issue was, and Guy Zazak talked about this, is that people coming out of the training programs, it's very difficult to get a water operator job certification. But what our graduates can do is they can get the entry-level jobs, and then those who are able to move up the ladder and get on the job training can then work themselves up as a goal to an operator job. And so the trick is not to aim for the operator itself necessarily in these very large municipalities, but perhaps get the entry-level jobs and then work themselves into these operators. These are large municipal plants. Now, in Alaska, I guess you've got some smaller facilities, so someone might be able to step into the more dispersed wastewater facilities. But in the large municipalities, you're talking about an entry-level job who will receive training and then move up. So one of the approaches, since often the people that get hired aren't coming out of these training programs, is to employ the instructors, get the instructors from the wastewater treatment plants and get them to either teach a course or be a guest lecturer or work with you in some way so that they will get to know your students. If they are an instructor, they'll get to know the best students in the class or the students that they feel fit into their culture. And when they come out, they can move into those entry-level jobs. So when we talk about placement and working with employers directly, that's far and beyond the best approach. And getting into those employers is certainly through use of instructors, but also use of alumni. Once you have graduates, and this takes several years, and for those who have been in the business for a while, some of your best advocates are your alumni who could then recommend, particularly in smaller communities, recommend people to move into some of these jobs. And we find often alumni come back as instructors. Alumni bring in not only employment opportunities, but they also bring in recruits because they have friends or family that they know they've seen what they've done and how successful they've been, and they'll bring them in and have them come into the program. So definitely alumni and instructors from these potential employers. Organized labor, of course, is another hookup you want to make in terms of that placement. Entry into apprenticeship programs. Many, of course, this goes for the strong organized labor areas, Boston, Chicago, federal facilities. So you want to develop a good relationship with organized labor that they may also provide a path from your program into apprenticeship programs. Certainly, in terms of that employment, you want to, and some people have not talked much about tracking, and they fail to recognize the importance of tracking your students. Some of our strongest programs, for example, in Cypress Mandela, they track their students almost forever. They continually are building this alumni foundation, and it's growing and growing, and they're using, and they state very clearly how they keep in touch with all their students. Some of them, many are using emails and keeping in touch and producing newsletters, and they're building their teams not only amongst their students that are currently enrolled, but making that bond between current students and alumni and keeping that tracking going as long as they can, and also having those students come back. And often they'll use refresher training as a way of getting these students to come back and tracking them, and also using them as mentors. So to the extent that you can offer refreshment training to keep as a tracking strategy, it's something you may want to consider. But clearly, when we talk about these proposals, again, the landmines in your proposals are not talking about employment, not talking about working with communities. You definitely need to make sure that the most important aspects are covered, which are basically employers, community, and then, of course, leverage sources, who's going to be helping you and how they're going to be helping you. And that we call partnering. So, again, beef up your employment strategies, beef up your community relationships, and beef up your partnering. And all those kind of link together. You can see how they link together in terms of recruitment, placement, and training. So those are just a few of the things this last week of proposal development that you want to make sure you've included. Anyone have any questions about any of those or any issues? Okay.
I've got a question.
Sure.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. This is Susan from the WIB. Mm-hmm. So, I wanted to ask you, talking about employers, on page 7 of the RFP, there's one thing that says it is an eligible use of grant funds. And it says implementing job development outreach activities directed towards engaging prospective employers to be involved in the job training program and to hire graduates. So I liked, the suggestions you've been making about how to involve employers and get them into the program and be connected with them. But, it seems to me on the webinar, Joe had mentioned that we could provide incentives to employers to hire. Have you heard anything more about that? Because I'm reading here we can do outreach activities directed towards engaging the employers to hire. So might that also include providing incentives?
I think what he might have been thinking of is providing them with trained personnel with certifications ready to go. There are some state programs, and it's something you may want to look at. The people who are able to provide the kind of incentives you're talking about, and I am, are sometimes WIBs can do it, and sometimes the state can do it. But this program, I would not try to attempt to do that. In other words, the state of North Carolina several years ago, I had a program where if you hired people in some of these brownfields programs, they could do, give you a break on salary, or it might be able to give you some sort of a rebate. The same happens on many employment programs, but these funds are coming from a totally different source. They're coming either labor through block grants to the states, or they're internal within that state. Sometimes they're offered through the WIB,
Right. Okay.
Not anything you'd want to include your own funds for. The incentives I would offer the employers are one, primarily the people with almost $1,000 worth of certifications, depending on what certs. Recently, some of the employers in Durham, we had a discussion about that. They said their hirees come with about the total value is about $5,000 because of the time it would take, the downtime, the certifications, what it costs for the certs. And we all know the cost of HAZWOPR and lead and RRP and confined space, all those. So those are basically the incentives I would talk about. What I would, that would be a potential landmine, trying to offer something out of the realm of training. You know, now you can certainly bring employers in on employer nights, and that's very important. We spend a lot of time trying to get employers to bond with the program. And one of the things that Durham does that's very interesting is they have an employer night, and the employers all come and they'll have a speaker. I've been to this program a couple of times, and the employers have actually bonded with the program, and to the extent where some of the people sending out the emails as invites are the employers, and they've been successful in kind of delegating this responsibility to the employers. The other interesting thing I saw in attending these meetings is the employers get to know each other, and they actually start, they're kind of friends. They develop these friendships between competing companies. So there'll be two or three companies. You might have a lead remediator, and you might have a cleanup and different companies, and they're getting to know each other at these meetings, so they kind of enjoy coming.
Okay. So yep, thanks for that clarification, because that was it. I was kind of surprised that Joe had said that, and I was thinking, I know that, yes, we as the WIB, we could provide those kinds of incentives, combining funds that we have with the EPA program, but I didn't think that we could provide some kind of like wage support or something.
No.
So good.
And
thanks so much.
But that is a thing you would definitely want to include as a leverage partnership. These are the kind of things they really like, to the extent that you can get stipends. Now, are there the Anchorage people still online? They were on speakerphone previously.
Hey, yeah.
They have.
Right.
Oh, hey. I'm, now you were able to get stipends for your students.
Well, that's a little different. The stipends are actually, we have our, so they're the what we call, refer to as stipends. That's actually a food allowance because lodging them. So it's not, we don't actually give them stipends per se.
Giving
it
monetary.
You know, it's like 25. We do. We give them $25 a day for their food in cash, and then they sign up for it. But, I mean, they don't have any other for meal.
But, you know, any kind of leveraging you can do, and to you, it some of those things may seem insignificant, but they're very important to the extent that you get kind of double credit. You get the leverage credit, leveraging funds, and you're getting partnering. And you want to make sure you include it in both partnering and leveraging. The other thing that's very important is in kind. To the extent that you can get an employer to come in and become an instructor, you've got, it's almost a triple whammy. You've got, you can include it as part of your training. You can include it as part of your partnering. You can include it as part of your employment and placement services. And you can use it as leverage, in-kind services. And the leveraging of in-kind services is what's it worth for a half a day or of an executive, or 3 or 4 or 5 days of executives. Tremendous amount of leveraging going on. The same with facilities, even to the extent that you're visiting or using facilities, whether it's a wastewater plant that you're going to visit or whether it's a waste site. This is a time when you're writing these proposals that you do not want to be modest, because you might think, oh, this isn't a big deal, so we're not going to mention it. But no, you really do need to mention it, because they're a blank slate. And even though it may not be a big issue to you, just like the leveraging of lunches, that is a big deal, and you are partnering and you're leveraging and you're getting in-kind services and all of those things. And contrast two people writing a grant proposal. And one says, we're doing all these things, but, you know, they're not big things, and we're getting some things from the WIB and the other. And the other says, no, we're leveraging, we're getting in-kind, we're getting partnering, we're getting assistance for our students. We're, as part of our retention program, we're providing these services, which are leveraged from outside funds. When you look at these two proposals, it's very clear which one is. Now, I'm not saying it's a better program. I'm saying it's a superior proposal. And unfortunately, the sad thing that I see about these, we've evaluated proposals for many years. I wish that the evaluators could go to the programs, talk to the people, see what they're doing now, what they're planning on doing, and have that as the primary way to do this. But they can't do that. So all they're doing is looking at sheets of paper, and they're trying to be as objective as they can. They're not even doing site visits. You know, if these were bigger programs, they would take the finalists and do site visits. But they don't have the advantage of being able to do that. So they have to come up with some kind of ranking. And the only thing they could rank on is what's in the written word. Not even if they know you're the best program, if it's not written, if it's not spelled out, every possible thing that you can imagine, if it's not in there, it doesn't exist. And that's, to me, that's a sad thing. But it's the reality of these things. So in this last week, reexamine and say, oh yeah, we're doing this, and we're doing in kind. We've got these partners. Why aren't they in the proposal? They need to be in the proposal, because if they're not in the proposal, they don't exist in terms of these evaluators. So if there's anything from this call that might be helpful, I would say, do not be modest and put it all in there. Put everything you can think of in there. And this is a good time to do that, because we're in those final moments, and you can go back and read through those ranking criteria. Name names, add organizations, add leveraging, show how your program is going to move towards employment with these organizations you're working with, what that path is from recruitment to retention to placement, and kind of make that flow extremely clear. And always keep in mind, the big thing is, if it's not in ink, paper and ink, it doesn't exist. And just kind of keep that in mind when you're proofreading your proposals this next week, and kind of go from there. So anyone have any comments or things they would like to add in terms of those submitting proposals or those thinking about next year? Anything? Okay. Well, we tried to make these helpful hints. We're going to do a call on the 4th of February, which will be after these proposals are submitted. But we're going to move back into this mode of how can we go to improve our programs. And we're going to try to get some additional speakers to talk about some of the other federal programs and start talking about some funding sources and additional opportunities. So anyone have any questions before we go? Well, I would say good luck on your proposals. Do that final proofread. And I wouldn't say embellish, but I would say definitely put down, give yourself credit for all the good things you're doing. So.
Thanks so much.
Well,
thank you.
Well, thank you all. You all have a great week.
You too.
Talk to you on
bye
the
bye.
Okay. Bye.
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 Bye, Mike.